This week, the Dow Jones Industrials closed at yet another record all-time high, while gold tread water and the XAU actually closed higher. Welcome, everyone. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to all of our listeners. GoldSeek.com Radio is entering its 12th consecutive year here with another information-packed encore episode with four big guests. The end of 2016 was somewhat of a disappointment, I think, to many precious metals investors. Nevertheless, the markets are, for the most part, higher for the first year in many years, and there are solid signs in the weekly chart that the dollar is topping, and gold shares may have at least found a temporary bottom. Joining me with their thoughts on the sector for the new year, 2017, respected rogue economist John Williams of ShadowStats says the Great Recession of 2008 never ended, despite what the mainline media is telling us. Then Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, says if bonds continue their sell-off, the cost of financing stock buybacks will soar, liberating funds for commodities and in particular gold and silver. Then David Morgan, the silver investor, his number one rule for investing when everything else fails in the financial world, which you notice it almost inevitably does, there's always silver. Next up, Peter Grandich of Grandich & Company uses his decades of Wall Street experience. Although policymakers will likely raise rates in 2017, this recent sell-off, he thinks, is just a paper liquidation, clearing the way for $1,400 gold, music to the ears of all precious metals aficionados. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with an all-new non-encore episode. Hat tip to him and that work ethic and everything he's done here to help us for all these years. And the show returns next week with all-new guest interviews, including Chris Martinson from PeakProsperity.com. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, SchiffGold.com, author of several bestsellers and radio host. Welcome back.
Well, it's always great to be on GoldSeek Radio.
We appreciate that. Wanted to start off today with the big dollar rally. You know, following the presidential election, many investors, institutions caught off guard, probably two more interest rate hikes, according to the Fed funds futures next year. There's been a lot of adjustments since then. Do you think that this risk-on trade is overdone at this point? And what might that mean for precious metals investors, please?
Well, I think the idea that higher inflation is somehow a negative for gold is completely wrong. I do agree that the markets are correct in that inflation will be increasing, especially given the stimulus that, you know, a Republican Congress and President Trump may in fact deliver in the form of some tax cuts, some increased government spending. As a result of that, we're going to have larger deficits, and the Fed is going to have to monetize those deficits. Inflation is going to be, you know, is going to be moving higher. But that is a good thing for gold. It's not a bad thing for gold. What people are saying is that, oh, because we're going to have a higher inflation, the Fed is going to have to raise rates to combat that higher inflation, and those higher rates are going to be good for the dollar, and a strong dollar are going to hurt gold. But even if we do get one or two rate hikes over the next several years, quarter point hikes, that will not be sufficient to restrain the inflationary forces that would be building in the economy. And so even if rates go up slightly, inflation will go up much more. And so real interest rates in an inflationary environment will be falling, not rising. And that is very, very negative for the dollar, and it's extremely positive for gold. So I think the markets are jumping to the wrong conclusion here.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're really saying is that, you know, maybe we hit 1% up to 1.5%, what have you, over the next few years. Really, that's just a drop in the bucket as far as offsetting the actual impact of inflation on the economy and thus real interest rates.
Yeah, and I doubt, Chris, I doubt that they're even going to get that high. You're talking about 1.5%, and we'll have a hard time just getting through 1% on the short-term rates. But look at what's already happening to the long end. This could be the beginning of a huge collapse in the bond market. And, you know, Trump thinks, or the markets think, that we could get away with this fiscal stimulus. You know, the Fed's going to have to step up big league, right? They're going to have to do massive quantitative easing, because somebody's got to buy all these bonds. And right now, nobody wants to do it. Everybody wants to unload their treasuries. And so if we're going to send the budget deficit up to the stratosphere, who's going to buy those bonds? So, you know, you have all these people saying, oh, you know, now that we're finally going to get fiscal stimulus, we don't need the monetary stimulus anymore. No, we need it more than ever, because the only way we can have the fiscal stimulus is if we get an even bigger dose of monetary stimulus, because somebody's got to buy all those bonds to make those deficits possible. And the only institution that has a big enough checkbook to do it would be the Fed.
Exactly. And we saw that, of course, around 2008, 2009, for about a year or so afterwards. But, you know, the Fed officials, policymakers have been sitting on their hands since then. We've watched their balance sheet sit in limbo, if you will, for about 2 years now. You would seem to think that if this bond collapse were to continue, they'd have little choice but to prop up the economy and the sectors by buying up toxic debt. And we could see that figure, what is it, around $4 trillion balloon, maybe to the next level higher?
Oh, yeah. I mean, remember, too, the Fed has been bluffing for years their intention to shrink that balance sheet. Meanwhile, it hasn't shrunk at all. And it's going to have to grow dramatically in order to enable the larger deficits of the future, and especially if you look at what's happening abroad. Foreign central banks are major sellers of U.S. treasuries. I don't know where the private demand is going to come from. If everybody believes that inflation is going to pick up, why would you want to loan money to the U.S. Treasury for 30 years at 3%? So, you know, I don't think there's going to be any real private buyers until we get a significant increase in rates. But the problem is we can't afford a significant increase in rates because we can't afford to pay. So I think the Fed is going to have to, you know, I mean, they shouldn't, but they will end up buying those bonds. So people who are buying dollars, they're doing the wrong thing. They should be doing the reverse.
You think they should be selling dollars and that this could all be just a false rally, a false breakout? I mean, you do have to admit the greenback touching nearly a decade, but multi-year highs.
Yeah, well, it's at, 13, 14-year high, so it is more than a decade high in the dollar index, although it is a marginal high. I mean, we're slightly above the high we were, a year or so ago. But I think the dollar is in very dangerous territory up here. I mean, it's a lot of speculators who I think have gotten caught. Maybe they're being stopped out of some trades that they were in. Because, again, it's a misunderstanding. More inflation is not good for the dollar. It means the dollar is losing purchasing power. So when a currency is losing purchasing power, that doesn't make it more valuable. It makes it less valuable. The only way that higher inflation could be perceived as a positive for a currency is if you believe the Fed will aggressively fight to contain the inflation. I think our Fed will surrender and inflation will win. And inflation running out of control is not good for the currency. And when people realize that the Fed is all bark and no bite when it comes to inflation fighting, there will be a big reversal in the dollar's momentum. And, you know, I think people should be selling into it right now.
I mean, obviously, the housing sector, very sensitive to interest rate increases. There's been considerable boost to the economy, right, from real estate. If we see higher rates, that would seem to pull it right out from underneath the table. I mean, we could be looking at even more toxic debt then for Fed officials to purchase up. And what would be the stimulus? What's going to be the economic growth that keeps stocks, U.S. equities, at record highs?
Well, it can only come from more money printing. That's, you know, I mean, it's not real economic growth. It's just inflation that's propping up stock prices. I mean, that's what's been propping them up all along. And, you know, you've got all these people that are thinking, well, you know, it'll be like Ronald Reagan. You know, we'll get tax cuts and stimulus and the market will go up. But, you know, when Reagan was elected, we had been in a bear market for 15 years. Stocks were very cheap. And they didn't even start going up until, I think, the third year of the Reagan presidency, the second or third year. We went through a pretty bad recession. But, of course, interest rates started way up, and inflation was very high, and so we were able to bring it down. But we're now, you know, we've got interest rates that have no place to go but up, and we have stock market that is already extremely overvalued. So it's hard to see a repeat of the experience then, especially since, you know, when Reagan jacked up the deficits, we went from about 30% debt to GDP to about 50%. We're already at 105%. So we can't grow the debt now the way we did it then because we can't possibly finance it. You know, so this is a different world that we're living in. And if we want to move from a bubble to a real economy, the bubble's got to pop, and that means there's going to be a lot of short-term pain in order to, you know, turn this corner. But nobody's ready for that.
For several years, as precious metals corrected, we saw commodities slowly decline along with West Texas Intermediate crude for the most part. We continue to find support in commodities, in the CRB, in crude oil, despite, you know, the dollar breakout. Do you see that as a positive divergence within the markets for the yellow metal and silver?
Yeah, well, I think that you're going to see a move up in commodities because of increased inflationary pressures brought up by central banks all around the world. And certainly if the Federal Reserve is going to have to print even more money to monetize even larger deficits in the wake of the fiscal stimulus coming from tax cuts and increased government spending to fulfill, you know, the political ambitions of the Republican Congress and the promises from Donald Trump. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot more inflation, and so commodity prices are going to rise substantially as paper currencies lose value, particularly the dollar. And as the dollar is weak, I mean, if the dollar is losing value relative to other currencies, that is generally the best environment for commodities.
Now, we've just, as you mentioned, seen a bond rout. Do you think that we could see the equities return to the mean? Because obviously bonds are not likely to rally back up to where they were. There has to be a meeting point somewhere. Where do you expect those funds to flow?
Yeah, well, if the bond market continues to sell off, stocks are going to ultimately follow. I mean, because interest rates are a primary component of stock market valuations. But also, companies are borrowers of money, and if interest rates rise, so too does the cost of, continuing that to finance that debt. And a lot of companies have debt that rolls over, it matures, and they reissue it. There's been a lot of corporate share, buybacks over the years financed with debt. So there are a lot of problems for the stock market if interest rates keep rising. So if they do, the market's going to roll over. But, you know, to the extent that the Federal Reserve doesn't hike rates in December, we'll see, or indicates that their rate hiking is over, there could be some kind of a bounce in the market. But I still think that the long end of the market could be under some real pressure here unless the Fed launches another round of quantitative easing where they commit to buying more bonds on the long end and putting a floor beneath the price. If they don't do that, I think that this, you know, decline is going to continue, and at some point it is going to weigh heavily on the stock market and certainly the real estate market too, which, you know, we just had a big number came out today on home sales, but this was, you know, from a couple months ago. But now you've got mortgage rates that have gone since the election from about 3.5 or just below 3.5 on a 30-year fix to now about 4.125, 4.25. Even though those are still low rates, you know, historically, they're not nearly as low as they were. And if you've got record high home prices and now mortgage rates start to go up, that makes homes that much less affordable. And people are already struggling because, you know, their jobs are not, you know, they don't have the incomes and the cost of living has been going up. So the main prop for the housing market has been the really, really low mortgage rates. And now those rates are not as low as they were, but they can certainly keep rising. I would not be surprised to see the rate north of 5% by the time Trump is elected. And maybe even we could be at 6% or more, you know, early next year. And, you know, I just don't see how we can support the current home structure. I think we'd have to have a 20%, 30% decline in real estate prices if mortgage rates were at 6%. And, you know, what's that going to do to the banks, you know, when all their collateral collapses? How many people will still make their mortgage payment if the value of their house goes down? I mean, so this is some very serious stuff that's going to be happening if rates keep rising.
Exactly. I'd keep my eye on a new housing starts. That seems to be most closely correlated with the overall Case-Shiller index, I think, nationally. It's a pretty good proxy for the market. You know, you talk about the inauguration in July. Where will investors park their funds?
Look at what happened the last time that we transitioned from Democrats to Republicans. It was when Clinton left and Bush came in. And, you know, during the latter part of the Clinton presidency that we had a huge dollar rally. You know, commodities were down, emerging markets were clobbered. But when the Clinton surpluses turned into Bush deficits, the dollar began a huge bear market, a seven-year, eight-year decline. The dollar index went from 120 down to 70. And, you know, gold went from under 300 to 1,000. Oil went from 20 to 150. And the emerging markets took off. And so I think if we get another exodus from the dollar and the U.S. bond market, that's where investors are going to go. They're going to go back into commodities, into emerging markets, into foreign currencies, into precious metals, and I think in an even bigger way than they did last time.
It certainly seems as though investors have maybe overreacted on the downside, given this new probability of higher rates in 2017. You know, if we look historically at the 70s, most of our listeners will know that rates were climbing most of during the 70s, and precious metals soared in one of the most spectacular bull markets in history. Do you see potential for history to rhyme this time?
Well, certainly the big catalyst for the move up in commodities in the 70s was the dollar, you know, going off the gold standard. And so the U.S. dollar being marked down accordingly, because it used to be backed by gold and now it was no longer backed by anything. And so there was no more restraint on the ability of the U.S. government to go into debt. And there was no real value behind our currency. And so there was a substantial decline. At the end of that, you know, we still maintained the reserve currency status of the dollar, even though it was no longer backed by gold. It was still accepted at a reduced rate, right? It was marked down, but then the world continued to accept it as a reserve currency. I think the next step in this evolution will be to reject the dollar as the reserve currency. I mean, it should have been rejected in the 70s, but instead the world held on to it, and that is the source of a lot of these major imbalances. But I think when the world realizes the predicament that we're in, when the Fed cannot deliver the rate hikes that have been anticipated, when they end up expanding rather than contracting their balance sheet, and when people realize that this is an indefinite expansion, QE infinity, and there's no way to restrain inflation, then I think there's going to be a crisis in the dollar, and I think the dollar will cease to function really as a reserve currency, and that will complete the process that began in the 70s, and this could be an even more bullish environment for gold.
But under this scenario you've outlined, shouldn't there really be a go-to reserve currency? Are you predicting then that the yuan, certainly not the euro, which has been struggling?
I think they'll go back to gold. I mean, why do they have to substitute another flawed fiat currency for the dollar? One of the reasons that a lot of people use currencies as opposed to gold is because of convenience, right? I mean, it's easier to transact in dollars or euros or yen than it is to transact in gold bullion, right? People have their gold, they store it in their house, but if they want to actually spend it, it's much more difficult. But that's not even true anymore. I mean, you take a company like Gold Money, which I'm now involved in. I mean, Gold Money allows individuals to earn, save, spend, transact in gold as easily as they can in currency. In fact, easier. Right? Anybody can go to goldmoney.com and open up an account online. It takes a few minutes, and then they can turn whatever quantity they want of dollars or euros or yen into gold. They can use their MasterCard or Visa, American Express, or they can do a bank transfer, and they can buy some gold. And now they own the gold, and it's stored in a vault for them. They can choose where they want it vaulted, but you can buy any quantity that you want, and then you can use that gold. You can spend any portion or gift any portion of the gold that you want to any person you want or any company you want anywhere in the world instantaneously. You know, you can make transfers for free to other individuals who can transfer to somebody else for free. You know, there's small merchant charges if people want to be a merchant, but you can set your business up so that your suppliers or people that pay you are going to pay you in gold. Either they can pay you directly in gold, or their fiat currency can be converted instantaneously to gold as they pay you. So using the internet, you know, a company like Gold Money actually takes gold, the safety and the store value of gold, and makes it as convenient, if not more so, than government-created money for commerce. And so I think as people start to lose confidence in the dollar or other fiat currencies, more and more people will convert their savings into gold. And with the technology of gold money, you know, they can utilize their gold in their daily lives. You don't even need a bank account anymore. I mean, when you have a gold money account, you can get a debit card. Soon you'll be able to get check writing. So if you can get a debit card that's attached to your gold holdings, if you can get a checkbook where you can write checks against your gold holdings, what do you need a bank account for? Why do you have to hold any fiat currency? People can have their income, their paychecks, directly deposited into gold. And then if your landlord will accept, you know, gold in payment of rent, well, fine. You know, and, you know, you can just pay all your bills in gold. I mean, believe me, if I was a landlord, I'd want my tenants to pay me in gold. Why not? I'd rather get paid in gold.
Sure, theoretically, it's great. But you have to wonder, though, as big of a proponent as I am for Bitcoin, Litecoins, Ethereum, all of the crypto alternatives, the thing that I think is keeping some people up at night is the worry that, you know, politicians and policymakers can, at the stroke of a pen or a key, I guess it's a mouse click nowadays, change the playing field. I mean, look at India. People wake up, large bills are outlawed. That's something like 86-90% of their economy evaporates.
That's another reason to prefer gold. I mean, it's harder for them to outlaw that. I mean, although it's certainly happened in the past. But, you know, the problem with the cryptocurrencies, of course, is you have to have faith that the cryptocurrencies will store value. We don't know that. They don't have a long history of storing value because they're just brand new, whereas gold has a 5,000-year history. It's pretty easy. I mean, would somebody, for example, would you take your life savings and turn it into Bitcoin? You don't know what it's going to be worth in 5 years or 10 years. It may be worth a lot. It may be worth nothing. But you have pretty good confidence that gold will always have value. And, you know, you can have, there's historic relationships between gold and other commodities. There's no historic relationships between Bitcoin or any of these coins and anything because they have such a short history of being in existence. But the thing about gold, why it's hard is, like, when you have an account with gold money, gold is your property. And so now you're dealing with property rights. And a lot of governments are not going to, you know, violate your individual property rights, your right to own property, because taking your gold in that is like just seizing your house or seizing your car or, you know, your other personal possessions. I mean, there are laws that protect private property. And so that's what's protecting people who own gold. Now, of course, you know, countries go communist and, you know, they seize private property, but, you know, when that happens, we're going to have a lot more to worry about. I mean, certainly your paper currency will be worthless too under the circumstances where the governments are trying to seize private property.
We really appreciate James Turk's gold money. I mean, he's been a huge friend of the show for quite some time, a remarkable business plan they have there, and it's working very well. But I would just make a couple of quick comments about cryptocurrency, in particular about Bitcoin. You know, I think folks forget the fact that thousands of Bitcoins are lost each year. There is just a fixed number, unlike every currency currently in the world that has virtually no gold or silver backing. They can print as much as they like into existence, theoretically at least. That blockchain is fixed in the Ethernet.
You do have a cap on the supply, right? But there's the other factor is demand. And the question is, you know, will people always want Bitcoin, or may they want something else, and may the demand for Bitcoin plunge because somebody comes up with a better mousetrap? I mean, so since gold has actual physical properties, since gold is desired outside of its monetary function, right, there's always going to be people that want to use gold, whether it's for jewelry or whether it's for electronics or whether it's for medicine or all the various uses for this very rare element, right? Those uses will exist beyond whether or not people want gold as money. But the only reason for Bitcoin to exist is because people want to use it as money. And if people decide they don't want to use it as money anymore, then it has no other use. And so it's now worth nothing. So that's the risk that you take. You know, yes, you know, there's a limit to what the supply is, but if there's no demand, then it doesn't matter what the supply is. If the supply is worthless. So I'm just not worried about that happening with gold.
What I was really alluding to is more of a symbiotic-like relationship. If you could have transferred gold, okay, let's say converted it into Bitcoin or Litecoin, what have you, and sent it to New York or Chicago, San Francisco, and had it converted into gold when you got there.
But the thing is, today, you know, using gold money, you don't have to convert your gold into anything to send it across the world. You can be in Europe and you can send your gold to America instantaneously. You never have to convert it to anything. So that's the power of the platform, that you're taking gold and making it instantaneously transferable anywhere in the world. Like, you know, because you don't have to transport it, because your gold, let's say you choose Zurich and you're storing your gold in Zurich, it doesn't matter whether you're in Japan or Australia or Canada. I mean, the gold's sitting there in Zurich, but you can access it from anywhere in the world. You can spend it from anywhere in the world. You can direct it to anyone you want. So you don't have to move it around. The gold is stationary, but you're portable. You're mobile, but you know, you can spend it. So it's the reason that governments were able to get people to use paper is they made it more convenient than lugging around bars of gold. But the internet now makes it even more convenient to use gold. It's actually cheaper. If I wanted to send you a tenth of an ounce of gold right now, I can do it cheaper than sending you $100. Right? I mean, it's easier. I can move it to you for free. If you had a gold money account, I can send it from my gold money account to your gold money account. It's free. How am I going to send you $100? I mean, I can put a $100 bill in the mail and send it to you. I mean, that's, you know, that'll take a little while. I got to buy a stamp. And if I wire it to you, my bank is going to charge me like $10 or $15, you know, or if I send it by Western Union.
How do you address anonymity factor that Bitcoin offers?
Look, yes. I mean, obviously, cash is anonymous, right? To the extent that I can put a $100 bill in the mail and send it to you, and that transaction is anonymous, right? So there are people that desire that quality. And Bitcoin, in a way, gives you that. But, you know, since it's all on the internet, I'm not sure how anonymous it is, because, you know, the government can track all the stuff we do online. So I know there's ways that, like, I can own a Bitcoin, and maybe I can write down the number of my Bitcoin on a piece of paper and hand it to you, and maybe I can transfer it to you in an anonymous way. But I think the way most people deal in Bitcoin, where you're using your computer, I'm pretty sure the government can track everything you're doing. It's not going to end up being that anonymous to the government. I mean, it might be anonymous, you know. I mean, if I decide that I'm going to spend my Bitcoin, it may be anonymous to you that I've done that. But ultimately, the big brother, I think they'll be able to crack down. And I do think that a lot of people who potentially are utilizing cryptocurrencies in a way that helps them avoid taxes may find themselves with a pretty big tax bill, because the government will probably be able to go back and dissect a lot of these transactions and hit people with a lot of bills, because they don't like the fact that it's private, right? The government, you know, that's one of the reasons they want to eliminate cash. They want to track everything we're doing.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about precious metal stocks. Our listeners are big aficionados of the yellow metal and silver companies. I'd like your thoughts here, whether we're overdone on the downside.
Well, you know, I think the reaction to the election, the sell-off in gold stocks, is way overdone, because the idea, again, that inflation, higher inflation, is bad for gold is just completely ridiculous. That's exactly why people want to own gold, and an increase in inflation is going to be beneficial to gold, and obviously it's going to be beneficial to the companies that own it and are mining it and selling it, and people should take advantage. You know, we have our own gold fund, the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund, EPGFX is the symbol. Aaron Day is my sub-advisor. That fund, I believe, Morningstar had me ranked as the top gold fund for the first half of this year, and as of today, I believe we're the number two fund. It is about 70 gold funds that we track, and I think we're number two performance. So I think Adrian is doing a great job. We have a really good portfolio of mining companies, and it's very difficult on your own, especially if you want to get into the junior mining sector. We have a good portfolio there to know the real value from, you know, the frauds. There's unfortunately not everybody in the business is honest, and not every gold mine is worth anything. So you got to really know what you're doing if you're going to go into the juniors. If you're just going to buy the major companies, I mean, yeah, you could just buy the big blue chip companies and, you know, you'll make money, I think. But if you want to get, you know, some of the smaller ones, you know, let a professional pick those stocks for you. And we're doing a good job in the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. So that's one way for people to really, I think, participate in what I believe is going to be a huge bull market, is to own my gold fund. EPGFX is the symbol. People can buy it pretty much anywhere. You know, check your prospectus, make sure it's suitable. You can withstand the risks. And people can also buy it if they have an account with me. You know, at my company, Europe Pacific Capital, my brokers, you know, can buy the fund for you. This is professionally managed. And, you know, so, and I think that we add value as managers. I don't think just blindly buying and holding an index, you know, is the best way to go. I think that we could, you know, we could look at these stocks objectively and decide which ones are the best. And we can also decide when a stock might be expensive relative to another stock, and we can sell one position and buy another stock. I think doing that using your brain is going to long-term deliver higher returns than just mindlessly owning an index. You know, I think for, you know, some people think that that's all you need, right? Just, you know, that somehow, you know, you can't beat the market. But I think that over the long run, the market is pretty easy to beat. And, you know, so it's kind of easy to beat them if you're disciplined and you know what you're doing.
Any other contact information you'd like to leave today?
Yeah, well, people, you know, don't forget, I'm constantly doing stuff on the internet, my YouTube channel, The Schiff Report, schiffradio.com, my podcast, you know, check out my books, you know, my latest one is still, I think, very relevant, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country, and, you know, go to the website, shiftgold.com or Europac Capital, europac.com, sign up for my, you know, newsletters or my, all the reports that we put out, and make sure you're on my mailing list, you know.
We want you to have an excellent 2017.
You too.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, my featured guest today says the economic collapse of 2008 and 2009 really led to a great recession that may still be underway. There just hasn't been the recovery reported by the mainstream media outlets. John Williams from ShadowStats joins us on this holiday. Happy Thanksgiving, John Williams.
Well, and a happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Thank you so much for having me.
You've really disseminated some fascinating information. This would have some folks burned at the stake a few generations ago. According to your work, if you can believe the headline numbers, unemployment in this country, national unemployment, peaked at around 10% during the Great Recession, and since then has slowly declined to under 5%. I think it was 4.8 or 4.9 at last look. You're not convinced of this. Your numbers say that the alternative unemployment measure, which counts discouraged and displaced workers, actually remained static at around 20 to 23%. It impacts every level of the economy. Give us the implications of your work.
I've been a private consulting economist for 30 plus years, and early on I found I had to get a real solid idea as to what the government was doing with their numbers in order to give meaningful forecasts to my clients. What I found over time was that what the government was reporting, those numbers were diverging. Over time, I found that basically Main Street USA has a lot better idea of where economic reality is than the headline economic statistics. A lot of it is how you define the numbers. With the unemployment rate, it's very specifically a matter of definition, where the headline unemployment rate, the one that right now is down at what some on the Fed are claiming is a full employment level of 5%, roughly 5%. That's nonsense. The way they define it, it's a measure of, to be counted as unemployed, you have to be out of work and you have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. It's a matter of definition. The to be counted as unemployed, in the headline numbers, you have to obviously be out of work, but you also have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. If you haven't been actively looking for work, let's say you've been unemployed for 6 months and you're just not finding any jobs and you give up looking for work, but you still want a job, the government considers you a discouraged worker. It's a term they use. And they'll put you in a separate category that takes you out of the headline labor force. The headline labor force, when you look at how they calculate the unemployment rate, the labor force is just the number of employed plus the number of unemployed, and the unemployment rate's the number of unemployed divided by the labor force. So if you're counted as unemployed and a part of the labor force and the unemployment rate's at 5%, that's a much lower level of unemployed count than I see. And the guy who's been unemployed for a period of time and has stopped looking, he just drops out. Drops out of the government's numbers. Now, they'll count him for a while in the government's broadest unemployment measure. They have six measures called U6. And there he'll be counted a year as a discouraged worker, but after a year, he's no longer counted as a discouraged worker. Just dropped from that. The difference is right now that the headline unemployment's around 5%. The U6, which is the broadest government measure, is around 10%. But once they drop out of the headline measure, and the same thing happens after a year, if they're discouraged, they're no longer counted. Well, back before 1984, when they changed the system around, and that's because we were getting NAFTA put into place, and there was a lot of expectation that it was going to cost people jobs, and it wouldn't be too good a political idea to show the real long-term discouraged workers. So they changed the way they defined the series. If you add back in the long-term discouraged workers, the displaced workers, occasionally in economic downturns as we've had, I estimate it's up around, the unemployment rate right now is up around 23%. Putting that in perspective, I'll contend that if you went around the country was unemployed, that's about the number you'd get. It's because of the underlying reality there, the economy is worse than what the government's reporting, probably more so than anything else that gave us the political overthrow we've just seen in the presidential race. Mr. Trump picked up on the fact that people responded, and he's now the president-elect. What's happening here? Back in 92, George Bush was running for re-election. The economy had been in a recession, and there were people associated with the administration who went out and GDP numbers boosted the GDP. The recession ended. Hip, hip, hooray, except that nobody believed it. George Bush didn't get reelected. Economic well-being, the pocketbook issues, more than anything else, tend to drive presidential elections. And you can see that when it's been below generally 3%, when real disposable income has been below 3%, adjusted for inflation, the incumbent party has always lost the White House. That's since 1932 when you have the first numbers. Other issues, of course, here other than just the employment. You have the payroll employment. You have that's probably more of a market driver than the unemployment rate. It's a survey that's conducted of industry in terms of how many people they have on payrolls. So that if someone actually has a part-time job, or two part-time jobs, or three part-time jobs, where the payroll gets reported to the government, they're counted three times as being a household survey where you only get counted once, irrespective of how many jobs you're holding down. So when you see a surge in payrolls, that sometimes reflects more people taking on multiple jobs. But they also have upside bias factors that were added into that system back in the 80s, in the coming out of the 1983 recession. The Bureau of Labor Statistics was in an embarrassing political situation where they actually underestimated the number of jobs being created coming out of that recession. So what they did was they put in what they called a bias factor, adding in about 160,000 jobs per month for good measure, so they didn't have to worry about understating the employment. And that varied some over time, and as they received some criticism on it, they formalized the model. Now it's called the birth-death model. But basically, it's a fudge factor, adding a couple hundred thousand jobs a month in there to, for good measure, to keep the numbers on the plus side. The GDP. Now, that's the broadest measure of the U.S. economy. It's what most people will follow. You say, what's the economy doing? They'll look at the GDP and say, oh, here's what the GDP is doing. Well, it's the broadest measure of the economy. It's currently published. But it is very heavily politicized, very heavily gimmicked, very heavily modeled. If you believe the GDP reporting, the economy crashed from late 2007, collapsed into 2009, and then rebounded. And it now stands about 13% above where it was before the recession, above the prior peak in the economy before the recession. That's adjusted for inflation. That's the way they normally look at it. The problem is there's nothing else that's showing that. If you look at industrial production, which accounts for roughly 65% of the GDP, right now that's down something like 1.5% from its pre-recession peak. The manufacturing sector there is down 6% from its pre-recession peak. Never recovered. Retail sales are higher, and there's some reasons for that. Basically, poor quality and adjustment for inflation. But even there, with the spike numbers, they're up 5% from the pre-recession peak. You look at elements such as the Cass Freight Index, broad measure of freight activity, broad measure of economic activity. It's down year to year, still falling. You look at housing. You're down, depending upon the measure, anywhere between 30% and 60% from the pre-recession peak. Very difficult to come up with that kind of growth that they're advertising in the GDP. And as a result, most people don't believe the GDP numbers. They also think that inflation is understated, and they're correct. Again, it's a matter of definition. And in this case, you had a very open effort by the government to understate inflation. Changes that were made go back to the 1980s, but where it came before the public was in the 1990s with Alan Greenspan, and who headed a commission with his name. The way Greenspan explained it was that the CPI overstated inflation. And if only it stated inflation correctly, it would save the government a lot of money because it wouldn't have to pay as much in cost of living benefits for things such as Social Security. It would also push people into higher tax brackets so they'd pay higher income taxes. Well, if you ask them, what are you talking about, and how is it overstating inflation? The example he'd give is, well, suppose steak gets very expensive. People buy more hamburger instead of steak. Their cost is not going to be as high, therefore their cost of living is less, but that's not reflected in the CPI. Well, this is where you get into definition, because That is indeed a matter of definition. The national consumer price indices, and this is the way it was up until they started changing these numbers, measured what's referred to as maintaining a constant standard of living. If you want to use a CPI measure to estimate how much your income has to increase by or what you're targeting your investment return at in order to stay ahead of inflation, you want to be able to do so so that you don't have to cut back on your standard of living. You want to be able to maintain your standard of living consistent with at least with what's happening in inflation. And if you have to cut back on steak because it's getting too expensive relative to hamburger and buy more hamburger, that's not maintaining a constant standard of living. So what they did was they moved to change the CPI to sort of a substitution-based index. It hasn't been done fully successfully yet. They've made all sorts of gimmicked changes to the CPI, but they've also developed a new series called the CPI, the CCPI, the chained CPI, which in the not-too-distant future, we'll see what happens with the new government, but as it was planned, would become the new cost-of-living measure that would enable them to further cut cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security. If you're on Social Security and you don't think the payments that the increases you're getting cover your cost of living, you're absolutely correct. And it's designed that way basically to save the government money. The government is not putting out a more accurate CPI measure. It's not putting out a CPI measure in terms of what do I need to stay ahead of inflation. They just redefined it so that they'd come up with the smallest inflation possible that cut their expenditures. So you have factors like those. The inflation changes affect the reported growth rate. You look at the GDP, not as strong as advertised. One reason for that is that it has in it very low inflation numbers that are used in deflating the series. But if you're looking at economic growth, you only want to look at it with inflation removed. Let's say you run a store and you look at your cash register and your sales are up 10% from last year. Well, if inflation's up 10% from last year, then you're basically break even after inflation. It's important to know what inflation is. If you deflate by too low a rate of inflation, it increases the inflation adjusted growth rate. And right now we're seeing a general understatement, inflation rate used in calculating the GDP. It's an aggregate number, about 2 percentage points, which happens to be just about what the GDP has been growing almost exactly year after year, quarter after quarter when you average it out. It's almost like someone was targeting 2% growth per year. The difference it makes and what I'll contend has happened here is that instead of the economy crashing from 2007 into 2009 and then rebounding, it started turning down late 2005, 2006, crashed indeed into 2009, and bounced off absolute bottom, but then it effectively leveled out at a low level of stagnation and never recovered, and now it's starting to turn down again. You'll see that again, and then if you look at the housing numbers, you look at industrial production, you'll see it in a number of the broader employment measures that the government puts out, like the participation rate, which is also something along the lines of discouraged workers. You see rates there that are indicating that low level of participation in the workforce, low level of the population that's actually employed. These are the lowest levels seen basically since 1994, which is when they redefined the series. So that it's there are a number of factors that are confirming it out there. It's just that you just have to take the headline government numbers with a large grain of salt.
Exactly. No, we keep our grains of salt in dump trucks at GoldSeek.com. You brought up some really interesting points. I'd like to underscore at least one of them that I think has broad-based implications for all of our listeners today. And this will be a bit repetitive, I think, for our longer-term listeners, but for new folks, it bears repeating. If inflation is understated, as I understand it, our GDP deflator is also incorrect. So it appears as though, according to the official numbers, that the economy might be in recovery and the recession is in the rearview mirror. But when we look at the shadow side, stats numbers that have been at least theoretically corrected, more realistic, plausible inflation numbers, you immediately see that we've been in a recession for approximately 15 years, that meaningful work is more difficult than ever to find, and the actual recovery just seems to be the 0.1%.
The other side of that is basically lost some of his what used to be very strong employment opportunities. And a good deal of that is tied to trade deals. Again, this brings you back to some of the current issues that are being discussed in Washington, and factors that, again, helped Mr. Trump in his campaign were the reasonably easy time identifying with the problem. The problem with the trade deals. Free trade is a wonderful concept, and I love people in academia, but the problem of some of the theories they come up with is that they're handling such complex areas that they have to make simplifying assumptions, and you got to look real closely at those simplifying assumptions because that can affect the way things evolve. And the simplifying assumption with the free trade concept is that you have, say, two countries that haven't been trading before, and one makes one product particularly with a particular efficiency, and the other country makes a different product with particular efficiency, and they open up trade, and most of the production of one product goes to the other country and the other to the other country, but overall you get greater aggregate production, greater wealth to the system, and it should be, in theory, a positive benefit to everyone. The underlying assumption is that you're at full employment, and that hasn't been the case here in a long time, nor has it been with most of our trading partners. And as a result, when you have that type of a circumstance, the benefit goes to the low wage operation, and that's why I've seen factories shut down in the United States and move to the people who otherwise they maybe were high paid machinists couldn't get a job. Now they flip hamburgers. They may be employed, but they're not earning adequate income. What you'll find is that with the government's numbers, this is published by the Census Bureau, and they keep revising the numbers some. But if you look at their latest estimates, what was referred to as a median household income, this would be the middle level of income for a household in the United States, adjusted for their headline inflation, the CPIU, this is the one that most people follow. That adjusted for inflation, that median income now is below where it was back in the 1970s and 1980s. If you look at real average weekly earnings as published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, peak was in 1973. It's been downhill from then. And it's the reason is largely tied to the loss of the domestic productive base offshore and the higher paying jobs offshore. And again, that's a reason that you've had such economic discrimination, and again, some overturn in the political system and criticism of the trade deals. There are legitimate concerns there.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. Of course, the greenback has broken out to multi-decade highs recently. Many in the mainstream are at least citing the potential for another rate hike or two in 2017. And, of course, we're certainly going to see one in the December FOMC meeting, a quarter point at least. Do you believe that we will see higher rates in 2017 by our policymakers? And can you tell us just what that might mean for the domestic economy?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance the Fed's going to raise rates in December. The problem is they haven't done so other than back in December of 2015. They've been threatening it ever since. But they're bluff. The problem is that the banking system collapsed back in 2008, the panic of 2008. What the Treasury, the federal government did, I mean the Treasury and the Fed, did was basically use whatever stopgap measures they could put together without consideration of the factors that had actually generated the crisis, but to buy time to push the crisis into the future. What the Fed and the Treasury did with that crisis in 2008, they decided that they would save the banking system at all cost. They did whatever they had to do to keep the system afloat, to push the crisis into the future. They stopgap whatever they had to bail out. They guaranteed whatever they had to guarantee. Bailed out General Motors. They purchased AIG, the largest insurance company. Bailed out the large banks. Whatever they had to do, they did. And they bought some time. But they did nothing to address the underlying issues. And the average country wants out of the U.S. Treasuries, not into them. Big buyers such as China, Japan, South Korea, they're all selling now. The biggest buyer had been the Federal Reserve. That's quantitative easing. I think they're not going to have much of a choice but to go back to that, because where they talk about launching their quantitative easing programs to help stimulate the economy, that's nonsense. The quantitative easing programs were launched to try and preserve the liquidity of the banks, to bail out the banking system. They used the weak economy as political cover, but they knew that what they were doing with quantitative easing would never stimulate the economy. The funds were not going into the economy. They were going into the banks. They were buying out off bad assets and providing the banks with liquidity. If the economy continues to turn down, which it looks like it's doing, they're going to be seeing increased stresses on the banking system. I think they've already committed to, again, salvaging the system, not letting it fail, although it effectively failed in 2008. They're still going to do whatever they can to keep the banks from collapsing, which will mean more quantitative easing. And when they move towards more quantitative easing, irrespective of whether or not they raise rates in December, you'll start to see very heavy selling against the dollar, because it means we're going to have much higher inflation down the road. And that's going to be the long-term, that's going to be the long-term issue. The U.S. has got it, whether the Trump administration, if they have all sorts of stimulus packages in hand, that's wonderful. But they have to get around the problems they have with the Fed. The Fed is not able to handle its current circumstance, and it has to do something to satisfy the rest of the world, so people will want to continue investing in the United States, which means putting together some kind of a long-range package to guarantee the solvency of the United States over time. Right now, we have, including what they call unfunded liabilities, current value of that, the programs in hand, well in excess of $100 trillion. That's double the global economy. There's no way that can ever be paid off. The system has to be brought into balance, and that's not going to be easy. It's not necessarily even going to be a politically popular thing to do, but if you want to have a system where you can look to returning to normal interest rates, and I think, I mean, if you're borrowing money, nobody wants to pay higher interest rates, but if you're living on a fixed income, it was nice when you used to be able to get a return on your CD that was where it was not more efficient from a monetary standpoint, you just go out and buy canned goods because, again, goods are going to go up more in value over the next year than you're earning interest.
And, of course, we've also seen yields soar and bond investors panic, obviously ahead of the increased odds for a rate hike next year and higher rates to come in the United States.
I'm not looking at a normal economy here. I see some hope, of course, with the change in government. But I don't see. I mean, I'm hopeful that maybe something can be done. But frankly, I see the decades of living beyond our means and taking on obligations that could never be covered as being intractable.
Do you believe the globalists are setting up the new regime, because here we have the threat of higher rates, which is certainly not a positive for the housing market, you know, not to mention, the equities markets.
The higher rates used to be normal. The issue here, though, what you've got to look at is a possibility here of a very dangerous inflation circumstance. That is set over time. I mean, if there's no change made to the obligations of the United States and our ability to meet them, eventually you're going to see a runaway inflation. That's just the effect of paying off things that you don't have covered otherwise with money you've got to print to cover it. It debases the currency. You end up with a hyperinflation.
Right. In Venezuela, we're seeing one silver coin purchase $250 in groceries right now.
Well, that's the direction I'm afraid we're going in, even with positive changes here. But however that goes, you need to be covered in that area. And the way an individual can protect himself is to buy physical gold and silver and hold it. I prefer sovereign coins because they're liquid. Have some of your assets in that. You can write out most anything. You also probably should have a stock of emergency supplies as you would for a natural disaster. This being a man-made disaster, get stuff that you can roll over the inventory on. But if we get into as difficult a time as I think we have ahead of us, and this very easily could be in the next year or two, if prices get out of control, if the currency becomes worthless, you don't know that deliveries are going to be made to grocery stores. How are you going to get gas out of gas stations that are denominated in a couple of bucks per gallon? There are all sorts of issues that come with it. Eventually, the system will adapt. It'll adjust. You might end up with a barter system for a while. I imagine you'll eventually end up with a new currency. But it's best to have a little bit of buy yourself a little bit of an insurance policy so that you can ride out the rough times.
Do you see any dislocations or things that investors should be watching for on the horizon?
Okay, looking at what investors should look at, follow the dollar. Look at the dollar. If you hear talk of heavy selling with the U.S. dollar, and coincident that would probably see some sharp rallying in price of gold and silver, I'd get very nervous. And I'd get, if you already don't have some, get some physical gold, but hold it through the crisis. It doesn't help you as a hedge. For example, you buy the gold. Let's say you buy gold at $1,100 or $1,200, where you are now. Gold gets up to $10,000 an ounce. What the gold does is it preserves the purchasing power of the money that's put into it. And if you're going to end up in a system where the dollar, let's say, becomes worthless, you want to hang on to that gold until the system has resolved itself. Because what might be 10,000 in gold could become 100,000 gold, could be 100 million, who knows? But it's not, what it does is, again, is it preserves the existing purchasing power. It keeps your assets from becoming worthless, which they would if you just held them in paper.
Very good. All right, John Williams, we appreciate you taking time today during this holiday. And while feeling under the weather, any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I think you got it, shadowstats.com. Always happy to hear from people looking at the site and interested in what we're doing.
John Williams, we appreciate your thoughts. Please feel better soon. We look forward to hearing more from Shadowstats in 2017.
Again, thanks for having me, Chris.
David Morgan pens the Morgan Report, covers economic news, trends, overall financial health. And welcome back, David Morgan.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be back.
You are going to be doing interesting seminars, online seminars, where you'll be looking at this massive $200-plus trillion debt. I'm sure you've heard of Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff at Boston University, and he's been talking $199 trillion to $220 trillion in debt. These numbers start to lose all sense of reality when you get, this high. I mean, we're talking 10, 20 times everything produced in the United States by every man, woman, and corporation. These are enormous numbers. Tell us the implications, please.
Well, the implications are that you can't live a lie forever. I mean, I've probably said this many times, but it bears repeating. I mean, if you cannot print wealth, and we can't print our way out of this mess. And yet that's something that hasn't worked. So if it's, I don't know if it's Einstein that said it or not, it's attributed to him often, that continuing to do the same thing over and over and expecting a different result is a definition of insanity. So I can clearly state that the banking system at large, central banks in particular, are insane to believe that after the QE1, QE2, Operation Twist, QE3, which is QE to infinity, and the European banks following suit, is going to solve a problem when clearly it hasn't. And yet this is the only methodology that they really have. And then, of course, they have, I guess, another methodology, which is rhetoric. They have the ability to come out in public and talk the markets up or down based on this idea that they're going to change the interest rate, which changes the yield curve slightly on the bond market or the debt markets. But this is all smoke and mirrors. Basically, the curtain on the Wizard of Oz has been drawn back. And as continuing with that metaphor, there's only a few of us, maybe 5-10%, that have actually pierced through the veil, through that curtain, and seen it's this little man pulling levers like hell won't have it. And nothing's really taking place other than a bunch of, again, smoke and mirrors. The other maybe 80 or 90% are beginning to see through the veil and realize that no matter what is said and what is done, that nothing is changing for the better. And as the confidence factor declines more and more on a global basis, the confidence will lack of confidence will cause a run to gold. And that run to gold will spill over in the silver market in a dramatic fashion, because silver is a smaller market and more affordable for those that have lost confidence, not so much in the monetary system, although that's certainly a big, big part of it, but basically lost confidence in their governments to take care of them, for their corporations to take care of them, for anybody outside of themselves to take care of them. And this is a situation that very few in the Western cultures, the Anglo-American Empire, Europe and America, or North America primarily, is that if you work, you know, this job for 30 years, you've got this pension. If you pay into the social safety net program of some sort, that you will be in good shape. That if you've got a savings set aside within some government bond, you're going to get a certain yield and all these things. And yet none of those things are guaranteed. What is almost guaranteed is that all fiat systems fail. This one is failing. It hasn't failed far enough in every case that the majority has lost confidence. And I don't think at the top of the market, when the gold and silver prices on paper terms are astronomical, that everybody has lost faith in the system. But at that point, for all practical purposes, everyone has lost faith in the system. Now, can that be circumvented or headed off? And the answer is possibly, but the probability of that becomes less and less and less every tick of the clock. I mean, with what's going on in the geopolitical scene, which you may or may not get into, is screaming that this war mongering that's taking place is more than rhetoric. Bombs are being dropped. Lives are being lost.
Give us an idea whether or not you think this could be an end to the uptrend, or it's just a healthy correction.
Believe me, and I don't want to be data-driven, although data does drive some of my analysis, but I say some, not all. I think it's probably, I'm not certain it's over, but I think majority of it's over. I was very cautious when we had gone, 6 months or more into this uptrend, which was very, very enjoyable. Those that were members of the website were getting cautious statements from me as we're going into a top-level consolidation. And I recommended to all of the website members to consider taking partial profits or hedging their positions. And I did it early, which is when you want to do it. You want to do it when you're near the top. You don't want to do it after the fact. And I got a little bit of blowback. I mean, I put out some Twitter feeds about, taking profits and, look out below. And everyone's saying, what below? What's wrong? And some of my own website members, well, if it's only going to be a 30% correction, then you know, I'm not going to do anything. And of course, I can't trade for anybody, and everybody's an individual. You got to do what's best for you. So I did have a caveat, Chris, and that was it's possible that the trading had changed so much, and it has, that there could be a final move up rapidly. And I explained how it would be done, how it would be accomplished, and basically it wasn't really worth trading unless you were very nimble. But the commitment of traders was so obvious that there had to be a sell-off sooner or later. And, of course, it just droned on and on week after week. And, you know, I'm starting to think, could it be different this time? And I stuck to my guns saying, you know what, the probability is so high that they will win again. We just really need to take some profits and hedge, or both. And, of course, it took place, you know, recently, and the sell-off was rather dramatic. What's interesting so far, and what makes me hesitant to say it's over, is that on a commitment of traders basis, the open interest has dropped enough in gold for me to give a pretty positive outlook that, yeah, it's probably over, or the majority's over. But on a commitment of trader basis in the silver market, it's been rather insignificant, which means that I am not comfortable saying that, that there isn't more to come. However, the Chinese are back in the market, the SGE, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which basically has been taking on the long positions that the commercial traders have been selling, or the opposite of the trade, the shorts in the commercials. So more to be determined. I do think it's going to take a bit of time. I was talking to one of my associates before this interview, and he asked me what I felt at this time. I'm a thinking man, but some of this is gut feeling and a lot of experience, and it feels like we must remember that the sell-offs in the metals for this last 4 or 5 years until the bottom, which was, you know, early December or late November last year, we have gotten the lowest print in the markets basically on the last trading day each and every year for several years in a row, which means with this sell-off, are we going to experience that again? And the answer is TBD, to be determined. The rhetoric out there in the mainstream financial press is pretty negative gold, although there's a little bit of positive. And you're also seeing some well-known, pretty savvy type of investment firms that are actually coming into the gold market, Dreyfus being one that made an announcement today that they might be looking into the sector. So it's stronger than it's been. I am convinced that the bottom is in. And how patient do we have to be? Is this going to be a quick turnaround of, you know, a few weeks? Or are we going to have, you know, months ahead of us where some of the newly arrived to the bull market next move up are getting discouraged after a few months and decide to bow out?
You could see, as you've written recently and talked about, a potential V-bottom near the 200 period, the XAU gold and silver. All three found solid support. I'd like to move on to junk silver. You've been a big proponent, as have we. When times get tough, you know, it doesn't take an even great depression or great recession, as we saw in 2008, 2009. Barterability, you know, the usability of your precious metals. I mean, you might have a giant stockpile of silver, and we hope all our listeners do, in some warehouse somewhere or hidden, hopefully, on the premises underground. Who knows? You really can't take a 1,000-ounce or 100-ounce bar down to the local store or to your neighbor and say, hey, can I buy a couple bags of grain or wheat or whatever it is that's going to help you and your family get through these difficult times, pay the mortgage, pay the rent. Junk silver pre-1965, you know, U.S. silver coins do have a tendency to hold their value. People trust them because they're obviously de facto real money, and they have that silver backing, oftentimes 90%, and you can get them in very small denominations. One dime, you know, is basically 1/10 or 1/11 of an ounce of silver, can be found at fire sale prices.
Well, Chris, you did an excellent overview, and I'll just give you the rule number one of the 10 rules of silver investing. When I was asked to write the 10 rules of silver investing so many years ago for the investing rules book, that were really, it's kind of an honor to be in there because there were some really notable investment people that were asked. I mean, Investing Rules is the global investor book which includes tactics, strategies, and insights relied on by 150 of the world's most respected financial experts. So to be held in that class is kind of an honor. But, you know, I just started right off the bat with the worst case. And so rule number one, when all else fails, there's silver. So if the grid goes down, the banks close, there's a bank holiday, the stock market, circuit breakers pop. I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I'm saying if something similar were to occur, if there's a hurricane in your area, I mean, there's other scenarios that doesn't have to be global or nationwide or even statewide. It could be, you know, it could be an event in your city or whatever. So anyway, when all else fails, there's silver. That's rule number one. And I go on to state, no one likes to be a prophet of doom. But the simple truth is, silver is the world's money of last resort. Should a severe economic collapse occur, leaving paper assets worthless, silver will be the primary currency for purchase of goods and services. Gold will be a store of major wealth, what will be priced too high for day-to-day use. Thus, every investor should own some physical silver and store a portion of it where it's accessible in an emergency. I mean, I think that's pretty succinct. Certainly, I would, if I was going to change that, the only thing I would change is that should a severe economic collapse occur or an emergency situation locally, because again, it doesn't have to be a global or nationwide or even statewide or countywide. It could just be, you know, your situation in your little hamlet somewhere. And is everyone going to take a silver dime? And the answer is probably not. However, it's pretty easy to negotiate real silver, especially in an emergency, as a barter mechanism well beyond almost anything else you can name. And it's been done, you know, time and time again. So certainly thanks for bringing that up. In these trying times, I think it behooves everyone just to think on their own. You know, you can agree with me. You don't have to. But there isn't much harm in owning, you know, let's say face value, $100 in silver dimes. I mean, not only do you have an investment potential that could go up, but you also have an item that in the case of an emergency, it's pretty handy to have it.
A handful of silver dimes, you can pick them up anywhere. If you don't have a coin shop near you, you've got eBay. If you don't have eBay, there's 100 other places. What a fantastic investment. You can still get them sometimes at spot. Could be invaluable. Let's move on to something more timely. The Chinese yuan. You know, it was recently added to the SDR. It's now alongside with the greenback as a reserve currency. Of course, the IMF promoting. I'd like to know what you think this might mean for gold miners and physical precious metals on a forward basis. We have a new contender for reserve currency on the block.
But what it means for the miners and the precious metals, I won't comment on because I'm still studying the situation, but I can give you probably even a bigger, better picture. What it really means is the Chinese are in no rush to have a gold-backed yuan or have gold in the currency system. It appears, at least from all of my analysis and those that I have, let's say, over in China, that the Chinese political elite are very happy to go along with the Western banking institutions and play the currency game just as far as it'll go, which comes back to our initial discussion where, you know, continue to do whatever doesn't work in the currency markets. So in other words, you know, print more fiat, even though it's not working. So now that the Chinese are in the game, so to speak, or welcomed in by the Anglo-American Empire, and they're allowed to sit at the table, as a metaphor, with the SDR, and the SDRs can be issued on what's called an MSDR, which is a marketable SDR, which is basically a bond, and the Chinese can off some of their U.S. dollars and create SDRs, this gives them a lot more clout. Where they can continue to play the currency game. And if you read Jim Rickard's book, I think that he's honest about the SDR. He pretty much makes a case that there is no subset that's responsible for the debt of an SDR. I mean, the responsibility of the United States debt is the U.S. taxpayer. I mean, every U.S. taxpayer owes $165,000. Well, good luck getting that. So unless everybody's got a spare 165K sitting around, you know, good luck getting it paid back. So just continue to go further in debt, borrow more. So the idea with the SDR is that just the banks hold the debt and they aren't, you know, there isn't any populace that's responsible for it. So you can make this charade continue. And I don't want to misquote Jim. I don't have the book in front of me. It's not on my desk this morning. But he basically says it's going to work as long as you can fool most of the people. It is my words, not his exact words. But that's the idea that he gives in the book. In fact, he says about three times in about as many paragraphs that, you know, the SDR idea gives the bankers another mechanism to continue this, I'll call it a game, this system of printing money and prosperity, quote unquote prosperity, by continuing the system. So I said a lot to say this. I think that Chinese are very happy to go along with that system. Where I'm not convinced is that the Russians are. I think Mr. Putin is of a different mindset. And I think he is, and I don't want to sound like I'm anti-American. I mean, I love my country, but remember, love of country doesn't mean love of government. Mr. Putin is a situation where I'm not sure that he is very favorable to this whole SDR situation. And the BRICS, of course, are not. And, of course, that includes China. So it's a bit of a conundrum, you know. What's really going on here? Is it spy, counter-spy, triple spy? We had double agents, triple agents. I really don't know. I really have looked at it as hard as I possibly can through my lens and the people I know and the people that I trust. And there's many in our community that think it's a big setup. The bankers are sitting on top. It's just a problem, reaction, solution. That it's going to come out with a global currency, a global system, and all the elites are going to sit on top and laugh at us. I am not buying that totally. I do believe that there is a breakaway. Now, whether it's the BRICS or Russia alone or part of the BRICS, I really don't know. But I don't think that they're all cozy. I mean, just look at what we know for a fact. What's going on between the neocons and Russia is frightening as heck. We already touched on it once, but this is not just drums of war. This is getting very, very serious.
Just read an article across the wire that Russia is insisting that all of its students are returned home in line with your idea of the drums of war. They're preparing. They're not just talking. That's not just saber rattling. They're concerned that something big is coming. I'd like to talk a bit about the Metropolitan Plan, which I still feel is not getting a lot of play in gold circles. A sort of a cabal of folks who are planning for negative interest rates, NERP rates, in the United States, where we would follow the path of the ECB. And, of course, the BOJ, and now the PBOC, the People's Bank of China. That's for the big lenders, the overnight lending rates, where we could see policymakers make an abrupt U-turn in our overnight lending rates.
Yeah, the best article is by Porter Stansberry, and it's in the Crux. You can Google it and probably read it. I will comment on it. Certainly, one comment I've made, probably haven't made enough in the public domain, and perhaps not even in for the website members, is the bankers seldom lose. This is a fact. What they basically do is when the system collapses or is collapsing, they have this big meeting with, you know, the G7, the D20. You look at it after post-World War II with Bretton Woods, and they set up a new system. And so if you look at the Metropolitan Plan, basically there's three bullet points, and the first thing you have to understand is the world system of paper money is unraveling. Well, anyone that listens to a show like yours knows that. The second thing is that as the crisis unfolds, people in and around government who understand how to use the country's gold will be reestablished in the financial order. So that's something that, as you said, isn't talked about very much. Now, the question I ask on that second bullet point is who has the gold? And this is where we come back to the China and the SDR, because at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to be a poker game where you can bluff and say, I've got this much gold. I really think maybe not on a publicly disclosed basis, although that'd be the most transparent and the most fair way to do it in my estimation, perhaps in a veiled way. And it's my contention that very little unencumbered gold exists is owned by the Treasury of the United States. And a great deal is owned in the East, particularly China, Russia, and India. So then the third bullet point is, the third thing you have to understand is that government will almost surely do something to prevent you from buying gold when the panic comes. So as this unravels and as the, let's say, banking elite try to maintain their power by last chance efforts, which means probably implementing gold into some portion of the new currency system, whether it be tied to the SDR, whether it be backing of bonds, whatever. There's a lot of things that could take place. I believe it'll be some type of gold cover, which means it'll be partial backing and not fully exchangeable. It will be amongst the bankers only, and gold is implemented to gain confidence on a global basis. But as far as really being sound money again for the masses, you can rule that out, in my view. You could protect yourself. So the third point is that as this is implementing or being implemented, there are several things that could take place. One would be, one, the system will take care of itself. The paper price of gold could get out of the ability of the average person to even buy an ounce. That's one. Another one is a high taxation on it. Another one is preventing it from being bought due to certain edicts or mandates by government or whatever. So the idea here is that this system, when they have to go to the ace in the hole, the last resort, the last thing they can do, the one they really don't want to do, the one after the currency system slash SDR, if it works, plays itself out, then you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar that gold will enter into the equation in some way, shape, or form. And you should be or could be positioned prior to that and be very grateful you did. And let me caution somebody, or should I say everyone listening, and most know this without me voicing it, but some people get the idea after listening to somebody on, you know, the precious metals and get the idea that this is, you know, the only way to protect yourself and to be safe is to get precious metals. Well, that's probably a true statement. But when you buy life insurance or house insurance, fire insurance for your home or automobile insurance, you don't put everything into it. You put in what you need. And that's what I like to stress. I mean, 10%, one of the 10 rules of silver investing, when I wrote that, rule number 10 is too much of a good thing is too much. That's kind of a rough quote. I forget the exact wording. And so 10% is enough for most people. So, you know, a handful of silver coins, maybe, you know, a little bit of gold if you can afford it, that type of thing, doesn't mean that you have to overdo it. And this is a problem that I've seen again and again and again, is that people, and some with very, you know, very successful people that have, you know, going concerns, good small businesses, make a, you know, fairly substantial amount of money, and they overload in the sector because it makes sense. But they're playing kind of on their fears, and I don't want to put on, you know, anybody's fear. I don't like, you know, playing the fear card. I'm sure I come across that way at times. I don't mean to. These are, you know, until they happen, are hypothetical, but many of them have happened in history. So I don't want to downplay it too much. Probably overtalked it, but is this viable? Yes. Will governments go to gold? I think they will. How will it take place? I think this Metropolitan Plan gives a pretty good outline. I think if you're interested in it, you should, you know, Google it and read it for yourself and determine what you think about it.
Any other topicality that you'd like to add to the discussion?
Well, what I would like to do is urge everybody to go to the new domain, themorganreport.com. Get on our free email list. All we need is a first name and a primary email address. And I will send you for free the Riches and Resources Report, which gives you two movies to watch and a lot of other information. One is on stacking silver and gold in a very convenient manner. But the two movies are The End of the Age of Empire. It's called the Four Horsemen film. And the second one is The Empty ATM, which is a documentary about the financial, or I should say the currency crisis that occurred in Argentina in 2000-2001. So those are two movies worth watching, let's say, over the weekend, especially if you have somebody in your family that doesn't really understand the dynamics of where we are in the global economic system and what's going to take place in the not-too-distant future. It's for free. You get on our free list. These are gifts that I've put together for everyone, and it's certainly something that I would like to see more and more people, you know, come into the fold, so to speak. On top of that, you'll get mailed once a week with our insights And I'll admit we do some advertising on that list. I basically, you know, I needed to stay alive during this 4 or 5 year bear market. And believe me, without our free email list that we could use as a revenue source from time to time, without that, you know, I might have gone out of business like many of my compadres that are no longer publishing in the gold newsletter space.
This is a go-to resource. David Morgan, we're going to look forward to having you back on the show in 2017.
Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome our featured guest today, Peter Grandich of Peter Grandich & Company. How's the weather today?
Very good here, Chris. We were blessed not to be hit by the hurricane, but to all those that were, our prayers are with them.
Absolutely. You know, 107-mile-per-hour winds hit Cape Canaveral. Even right here, way up in the mountains of the Appalachians, there was some heavy storms, but nothing like folks on the East Coast. So, you know, we've also seen some other storms in the financial markets as well. Do you think the new bull or nascent bull is intact?
I hate to say this time it's different because it never really is. But there's clearly signs that this is not a rally in a cyclical bear market in terms of what's happening in gold. I think while 1400 would have put any little left doubt to bed from a clearly technical standpoint, I believe there's enough fundamental reasons to believe that the pretty bear market that we went from the highs from 2011 to last year is behind us. I think this is a simple correction, but they're never fun to go through. But they're the things that need to take place if it really is a new long-term bull market. So I'm pretty okay if someone is willing to look past today, this week, and this month, and particularly if they're willing to look out to 2017.
Looks like they're going to raise interest rates after the November election as soon as December. Are they just following rates higher?
I really don't think there's more than one or two interest rate rise in them if they go. I don't think this is the beginning of a long, drawn-out interest rise. So long as the three things that have underpinned financial assets continue to hold, I eventually believe one or more of them won't, and that's why I've taken the chicken in the foxhole approach. But the three things that have underpinned financial assets and still do as we speak is, one, what central banks have done. I've said that, barring an old Star Trek slogan, central banks have gone where no man has gone before. No one knows exactly how this will end, but everything you look at, it doesn't end well. However, it has put in a perceived floor to stocks and bonds with a feeling that you really can't lose a lot as long as central banks are flooding the system with money. The second thing is near zero and negative interest rates. This has really resorted worldwide to people and institutions to chase yield. And part of the places they've gone to look for yield is in the stock market. But most people don't comprehend the risk that dividend yields are not the same as yields that are normally received from bonds in the days when CDs used to pay or something. And the third, and perhaps the toughest reason that has kept things going the way they are, is what I call the all-in attitude. And that is a common question asked by anyone when you talk about maybe you should take some money off the table is, well, if I do, where do I put it? And they don't see any what they believe is worthy alternative. So they just keep it where it's at and then hope that they'll be able to get out in time if and when there's a change. The problem is hope is a wonderful spiritual strategy, but I can tell you it's a destined for trouble investment one. So I think those are the three linchpins that have kept the market going. I don't know the day or the hour when one or more of them break, but when one or more of them break, then we're going to see some very, very rough times.
Exactly. And, you know, we're seeing those rough times, I think, unfold right now in the Eurozone. I mean, Deutsche Bank, DB, blistered for several weeks, even months, with derivatives. And this is, I think, going to be the topic du jour on a forward basis, because obviously our six leading money center banks here in the contiguous United States have somewhere between 250 and 300 trillion in derivatives, notional derivatives. The point is there's a lot of exposure here on our financial institutions, and is there an easy exit plan for us? And if not, there has to be a day of reckoning.
I think the only reason it hasn't paid the piper, so to speak, here in the U.S. is because we're the reserve currency for the world. Japan has been in a quagmire, and we're seeing that in Europe now. And the big thing for 2017, God willing, we have the grace to be talking this time next year, would come as no surprise to me that the European Union has gone or begun to go through a true end of its life by one or more additional countries announcing or planning to exit the union. I think the most likely one is Italy. And I think if and when that happens, it just compounds the banking system problem that you already spoke about. So, again, these are really the linchpins that I spoke about are what's driving financial assets, fundamentals and all the earnings of earnings and things, toss them out. Markets are overvalued. There's not real growth in the U.S. But those are the three things that are keeping both the public and the so-called professional sector still entwined into financial assets. Now, why that's actually a positive for gold is gold doesn't even get a sniff of any of that money yet. Now, the natural course will be is once those linchpins look like they're starting to break down, it will get a sniff. So it's important and to appreciate that what the results we've seen so far this year, even after this correction, really come from still no real interest from the public at large, at least in North America. And so I really think that's why I have really strong feelings that it was a healthy correction. The physical market has stayed constant. It was paper-driven on purpose or forced liquidated, whatever it may be. But I think as we get towards year-end, we'll get back to that 1350, 1400 area. And if and when we get above 1400 and stay there for more than a couple days, then you can, without any reservation, put to bed the notion that there's any still bear market existing.
Some are deciding to either take some profits, the institutions, hedge funds, choosing the sidelines. But I guess relative to China's negative 3.75%, I believe, which is really a remarkable thing. And you talked about the U.S. dollar being a reserve currency, but even that is somewhat under fire lately, as we hear that the IMF just accepted the yuan as part of the key reserve currency basket and even gave them some favorability status, which, again, I think jeopardizes that hegemony of our greenback. But if we look back over some of the long bear markets that we saw in stocks as well as housing, it really did take 2 or 3 years to put in a solid bottom, even you might say the U.S. dollar before it rallied. I mean, it can take 2, 3 years, a few false starts, if you will. That offers prospective bulls an opportunity to pick up discounted opportunities.
I believe it's been a two-tier market even during the decline. The physical market has remained far stronger than the paper market. I think the changes to where the paper market now trades as we move more and more to Asia, the influence of the, whatever you want to call them, some people have called them the gold cartel, the manipulators, whatever it may be, I think they have less influence. As you can see, we no longer get whacked and then stay down for any real length of time. It's healthy, sure. People who are short-term minded don't like that. But understand this, it's been a really good performer. It did what it was supposed to do. No one, it wasn't a lot of people even giving it a chance to do what it's done. And therefore, I just think, like you said, this backing and filling and building a longer base is very rewarding for those that still, if there's still anybody out there left, that still looks out 3 or 5 years for your investment return.
Bonds have many of our guests here up at night. It's just a rarity where you have equities and debt at such high levels together simultaneously. Usually they are somewhat negatively correlated. Maybe we've had a big rally and let some air out of the metals. But, you know, we also have a positive theme underway, and I'm sure you've noticed in the CRB.
We are going to wake up after Election Day in the U.S. and have about at least half of the population just totally despising who was elected. I can't fathom or know of anywhere in history where that is going to be the end result. And that's going to have, Chris, that's going to have a tremendous impact on what we go forward on, because there's just going to be so much headwind for whatever group or ideas take hold of the office, that there's half the people are going to do everything they can not to see that go forward. And I don't think the markets have priced in at all that. And it may need and probably will wait till after the inauguration and after the pomp and circus that comes with that. But I think by springtime next year, we are going to look at America more divided socially and politically than it's ever been in its history. And I just can't see how eventually economically we fall into that same camp.
You remember what one of the founders of this great nation said? I'm sure it's already crossed your mind. And with regard to being divided, we must hang together or we will most surely hang separately. And we won World War II because we hung together. The ladies worked in the factories. The men fought out in the fields. Minorities ran the transportation system that gave Dwight Eisenhower and Patton the troops, all the support they needed. It was a remarkable feat of unity. Why don't you tell people more, please, about Peter Grandich and Company?
We are a business estate planning retirement specialist here in the state of New Jersey. We do it both for the general public and professional athletes, and our blogs can be found at petergrandich.com.
Thank you, Peter Grandich. Have the best weekend.
Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment venture. Bank and founding director. Their Sal George project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Rhea project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. I received quite a bit of feedback regarding last week's discussion on the Not-So-Affordable Care Act, and my view that in most elections, people in large part vote their pocketbooks, and despite frantic rhetoric to the contrary since the election, this time was no different. One longtime listener shared with me the facts and figures of his wife's situation and said I could pass it along. She lives in a major metropolitan area, is 54 years old, and has a health insurance policy with a major carrier. Last year her premium was $4,000 with a $5,000 deductible. This year her premium is over $8,000 with the same $5,000 deductible. That amounts to over $13,000 she needs to spend before the insurance company pays dime one. She comes close to exhausting, but never reaching her full deductible, which means she is spending about $5,000 out of pocket for healthcare visits every year. Her after-tax take-home pay is under $30,000 a year. She is spending nearly half of her income on healthcare between premiums and office visits. Every other plan she checked was only a little cheaper, and none of them allowed her to keep her doctor. On top of that, the doctors for the other plans all had significant waiting lists between 1 and 2 months to get an initial appointment. That is the state of health care for the silent majority in our country today. Corporate CEOs tell me healthcare costs at their firms are growing at astronomical costs. And the media and some politicians have been jumping from one excuse to another as to why the presidential election turned out as it did. It wasn't fake news. We already get that on the mainstream media. It wasn't the elections. We've already done several recounts. History does repeat itself because it was the economy, stupid. Merry Christmas to all of our Gold Seek listeners from across the globe. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. for two new big guests. Be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.